We talk about how the Mavericks have slowed down the Thunder's offense to take a 3-2 series lead. We say goodbye to the Cleveland Cavaliers, who might be facing big, big changes this offseason. And we dig into some of the early rumors and chatter flying around the NBA Draft Combine in Chicago. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, it's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. What is up?
Jake, we're getting closer. I can feel it. The number of series is declining. The number of teams remaining is winnowing down. Our time of trying to just stay constantly awake and caffeinated is drawing to a close. And I know everyone gets wistful at this time of year. I get fucking pumped. I'm like, cool. All right. We're drawing nearer to the finish line. But I'm sure for you this week, it doesn't feel like that. You've been a hard traveling hero. Where are you at right now?
Yeah, I'm still in Chicago. We're recording this before I run home back to New York for one night. And then we'll see where we go from there, depending on credential requests and whatnot, which we'll talk about off air. But okay. Yeah, last night, post dinner drinks, as the Mavericks win, I started clapping and I said, "Let's get this thing done in six, baby." And the people I was with were like, "Why? You're rooting for Dallas?" I said, "No. We're just rooting for the shortest amount of possible games. We're rooting for sweeps. Right. We're never rooting for overtime. We're looking for the lowest amount of minutes possible to be played on hardwood while we're covering it." Would you agree?
It's really true. Like, my wife doesn't care about almost any of it except for she's like, "Why are these going 6 and 7? I'm like, "Listen, Adam Silver's NBA, parity reigns." And she's like, I have a bone to pick with that guy. So I'm like, yeah, get in line. I think a lot of people do.
Let's start there. The Mavericks defeated the Thunder 104-92 last night, Wednesday night. We're recording this Thursday morning. I think Dallas, since game three, I think in game two, obviously they won on the road and the proverbial, we stole home court, blah, blah, blah. Luka looked like himself in game two a bit more than he did in game three. When the series flipped back to Dallas and PJ Washington was still doing PJ Washington breakout things, and Dallas had gone up 2-1 without Kyrie really having an inferno scoring situation like he was doing in all the second halves against the Clippers, it wasn't like Jokic figured out the Timberwolves defense level of like, "I feel confident that Dallas can win this thing in six," but I just felt more confident that Dallas could win the series in six than OKC could win it in six, if that makes sense. Again, we're looking through all this through the lens of how can we get this thing wrapped up? And that when Derek Jones Jr. makes three threes, it's not that simple, but that's incredible amount of found money in a series that's been an absolute dogfight. And every inch that Luka Doncic can free himself from Lou Dort or Cason Wallace or whoever has been a massive win. So if you get 9 points unexpectedly from Derek Jones, those are big points to me.
Absolutely. And they got more than that. You're right to say it's not as simple as our other guys make shots, their other guys don't, we win the series. But it's also not that simple, right? Like, the game plan such as it exists. I mean, like, there are PJ Washington baskets where it's like he's ahead in transition or an offensive rebound, and that's not game plan, right? That's just like he breaks contain or you lose sight of your man, or the physicality, just the size that Dallas was trying to bring in at the trade deadline. But to a certain extent, it's like, we are going to funnel the ball to these guys and say, if you, PJ Washington, guy who's never been this deep in the playoffs before, who is, a coin, not even certainly far off of a coin flip, like a 32-33% career 3-point shooter. Like, if you're going to make five threes, we're going to lose. Derek Jones Jr., you are a guy who is, an athlete and a transition guy and an offensive rebound getter. If you make three or four threes, well, we tip our cap, but we're not going to be, we can't let Luka and Kyrie destroy us. And that is what has happened for the most part. Like, it looked like the math was tilting in OKC's favor as of game four, where I think it was PJ had scored 19 on 19 shots and he would, like, Kyrie had only taken 11 shots. This is like, that is the game plan working out in OKC's favor. But in the individual small samples of these games, when, you know, Derek Jones Jr., I think it was, he wound up with 19 last night on 7 of 9 shooting, 3 for 5 from the corners, was perfect in the first half. Like, that's how you get in the hole that you can't get out of. And then on the flip side of it, when Mark Daigneault makes that big, he pulls the lever and says, we're going to move off Josh Giddey in the starting lineup and put Isaiah Joe out there because we want a higher likelihood of when the ball gets funneled to our guys, the our guy's going to make that shot. And we want to create more space for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, for Jalen Williams, try to create, you know, pull a little bit more of that packed in defense out of the paint for Dallas and try to give us some more driving lanes so we can get to our identity, that drive kick slash get the blender whirring. Isaiah Joe goes 2 for 8. And if Isaiah Joe goes 5 for 8, and, you know, then, you know, maybe we're talking about a dramatically different ballgame, but we're not. And this is what Dallas has been able to do to Oklahoma City over these last 3 games, especially. I mentioned this on Twitter last night. This is 3 of the 16, it's not a fun stat, but 3 of the 16 worst offensive performances of the season for Oklahoma City are game 3, 4, and 5. Even the one they won is one of those like bottom tier performances. Dallas is grinding this offense to a halt by saying, we're going to be on point with our rotations. We're going to be on point with our closeouts. We are not like, we're not so worried about Chet as a spacing five, or Jalen Williams, big Jalen Williams as a spacing five, that we're going to take our centers out of there. We're going to let those guys park and we're going to believe that we can get out. You're not fast enough with that release. You're not fast enough with the shot that we can't get out and bother it, either, you know, make you put it down. And Oklahoma City just hasn't been aggressive enough firing with a hand in their face, except for Lu Dort, which is how you wind up with Lu Dort taking more threes than any other member of the team in the series. And that's a trade-off that Dallas is going to live with every time. So yeah, you're seeing like game plans be borne out in real time. And just one team has outperformed their expectations on it and the other one hasn't.
Lu Dort, you're incorrect. Lu Dort is not leading the Thunder in threes. He is leading the Thunder in absolute moon balls that are looking like they're going to hit the Jumbotron every time. His arc is the highest arc I've ever seen. It's really impressive.
It's got to get up there to get over that flying hand coming out at them because, man, Dallas is contesting those like crazy.
I think the defense in Dallas is absolutely kind of it's the huge identity shift that this team has really embraced since the trade deadline. It's kind of been their calling card and their branding and all that jazz about we went out and we traded 2 first-round picks because we've got 2 all-star guards in their primes and the window is now and we like these guys more than maybe other people are willing to pay for them, so let's just do it. And that is all true and great. Also, Derek Lively is just really impressive, man, for being so young. Only 20. He's 2 years younger than Chet, which
that's crazy.
It is crazy to think about. And if we want to think about his kind of like mini journey throughout the season, you know, he has a really great start as a rookie, as a starter, and the expectations were kind of high. And people on the outside could look at them taking a lottery pick center who they were so high on in the beginning of the year and then trading for someone to move him to the bench and diminish his minutes as kind of like an indictment of a 20-year-old kid who is still growing into his body and has had to overcome since then the tragic loss of his mother. And that is not the case. If you ask everyone in that organization, they are all pumped about D-Live. And they watch this kid do something, whether it's switch out onto the perimeter and guard Shai, or just be rotating with the best of them on weak side help stuff, or being able to help Luka or whoever guard a pick and roll in a two-man scheme. Or I think most importantly, too, for this particular series, like in game 1, we were texting about it. I asked you for some statistical help. the lob portion of Luka's high pick and roll mastery, and Kyrie obviously does his thing off of a screen as well. Like, that just wasn't there. Whether it was Chet's length on the hedge or OKC's overall team scheme, like, it just wasn't there. And Luka said some kind of very pointed quote about how the bigs needed to jump off of 2 feet. And we talked about this with Vinny Goodwill on Monday, how, like, in game three back in Dallas, when Lively actually did that, when he caught it in the paint on the roll and just took off like he had jumped off an ejector seat into the rafters and dunked all over everyone. That to me felt like a moment that he had kind of figured out, okay, like, I know the type of physicality that is needed to be brought to this particular series. And it seems like he has kept that momentum moving forward. He's plus 22 in 23 minutes last night. He has been plus 16 or better in all three of the Mavericks wins. And he is closing games when he deserves to be. And it's a big moment for him in this overall picture of what Dallas has built. And I just wanted to give him a shout out.
Yeah, super well deserved. A lot goes into individual player plus minus, as you mentioned, but it leaps off the page. Dallas, over the course of these five games, has been outscored by 1 point. They're plus 45 with Lively on the court. And that's, you know, that is massive. It's the fact that, you know, we talked so much at the trade deadline about the trade for Gafford was about essentially giving Luka 48 minutes of lob threats and 48 minutes of rim protection, right? And Lively he hasn't shot great from the field. And Oklahoma City has made it a concerted effort to try to limit those lob opportunities to, I mean, Dallas got a ton of dunks last night, but a lot of that was sort of in transition or off offensive rebound, you know, like things that were sort of not just the sort of immediate spread pick and roll, get the tag, throw the lob that we saw from them so much during the regular season. Well, yeah, Lively's only 10 for 28 from the floor in this series, but he's making such a dramatic impact with his defensive presence. Again, so much of it goes back to just like Chet unlocked Oklahoma City's offense during the regular season by being the stretch spacing five that dragged, that could actually punish a team for sagging off the big man and dragged the big man out to the perimeter and shot whatever, you know, 40% from three. And in this series, and what you see sort of the difference between you're playing a different team every other night and you're getting one steady diet of a team for 2 weeks. Dallas is locked in on every one of those drive, kick, swing, especially because those drives from Shea, from Jalen Williams, from whoever, they're not getting deep in the paint usually. The shell has been so sound for Dallas to keep those drives to, like, you get to the elbow and then you got three bodies in front of you, so you got to make a choice. And if Chet is either in the dunker spot or like crashing in from the perimeter looking for an offensive rebound opportunity, then the center doesn't have to go anywhere. And then even if, you know, you're on the scramble drill and you're peel switching out and it's like, well, you've got a center in the paint, but Derek Jones Jr. is going to go pick up the open three-point shooter on the perimeter, they're betting and they feel confident, like, we're fast enough to get out to that shot. And then you, like, the best case scenario is what we saw late in the fourth quarter last night. Derek Jones Jr. on that long rotation, Chet takes a while to load up the three ball. He gets the block. He's able to get out, leak out after that, get the transition dunk, puts them up, I think, 13 with about 2 minutes left to go. Like, that is game plan and you know, discipline playing out in real time. And so much as, I mean, we talked during the regular season, a lot of people at the trade deadline especially were like, why didn't OKC make a bigger move to go all in? I was completely the idiot who thought that Gordon Hayward was a great idea. Gordon Hayward has essentially been like a ghost haunting the perimeter of this series at best. But the argument was this: they wanted to see what this core would look like in these moments. I think game four, that big comeback late, is a huge data point in terms of like Shea can be that guy. And we feel confident about our ability to bring this up. But the failings that you're seeing in terms of the speed of the releases, the confidence to launch with a hand in your face, when the ball is funneled away from your main stars, who is going to be able to step into and make big shots? This is all stuff that Mark Daigneault is going to have to, and that staff are going to have to build, and Sam Presti in the front office, build your next iteration of the team with the mindset of like, your windows are tiny. And when you get into these sorts of matchups against big, tough, experienced, athletic teams, and you gotta be willing to let it fly, a little bit of that Lou Dort confidence, but you need everybody else to be able to take and make in those situations. And I think a lot of this comes back to, and I've been rambling, but Jalen Williams he's had a big job defensively. Like Kyrie Irving hasn't had crooked number games in a large part because Jalen Williams is all over him like a cheap suit for the entire defensive, every time they're on the floor together, basically. But Shea's going to get his 30 no matter what. They need something else. They need another source of offense. And Jalen Williams has been that all season, and he has rarely been that in this series. And I wonder if the next sort of chess move for Mark Daigneault, if he's willing to shake up things again, might be like, what if Cason Wallace goes into the starting lineup? He takes the Kyrie assignment, and then that frees up maybe theoretically Jalen Williams for having some more energy to do some more shot creation, some more pull up off the bounce shooting to try to unpack that defense. It's a lot to ask of a rookie in an elimination game. It's a lot to ask of Jalen Williams in an elimination game, but OKC needs to ask a lot of everybody right now if they want to keep their season alive.
The Cleveland Cavaliers did not keep their season alive last night, falling to Boston 113-98, 5-game series, 4-1 advantage of Boston. That's what I picked in the predictions. I was right, Dan.
There you go. Right. You nailed it.
Not expecting Donovan Mitchell to leave due to injury and what have you, but we are going to talk about Cleveland and what's going to come from all the ripple effects of their loss with Donovan Mitchell's impending contract and cuts extension stuff in a second. But first, just a first takey type question. Is Boston getting this far in the playoffs without being tested a good thing? There's two sides of this to me. There's the, well, if you're in New York and you've been battle tested as anyone could be, like, will you literally have enough left in the tank? Will Jalen Brunson be able to continue this run and not have, I don't want to say it out loud, a Chicago type moment that people are definitely around the league starting to be like, yo, is this guy made of bionic limbs and feet and whatever, or is he human and is this going to have to come to a pause at some point? Then again, Boston, if you get to that stage and there is a team like New York who's ready to punch you in the mouth, maybe quite literally as they go for every offensive rebound imaginable, will you be ready to stand to that physicality? I would think that if you, we've seen plenty of teams. I mean, we've seen Denver get absolutely knocked on their ass at home and then turn around and win 3 straight games. So maybe if in that event, if Boston needs a test and they get it in game one of the next round, who's to say they can't absorb that, channel it, and send it right back in game two and make some adjustments and whatnot? I just think with this team in particular having a proclivity to not take some games seriously, to fade kind of when they need to, just to get through the gauntlet of the year, though, to not have to be like in playoff mode to the degree that other teams have had to be in. I do wonder if that's going to be something that they have to deal with early in the series. But yeah, to my point, I don't think that's going to be like a series long storyline. But when the ECF backdrop replaces the NBA playoffs backdrop and the tone changes, I do wonder if they're going to have a bit of a challenge just like rising to that level of physicality and just like even playing with responsible doubt that can charge you to do things from a competitive standpoint that they haven't really had to do so far.
I love that turn of phrase, responsible doubt. It reminds me of like what Pop would say to be like the appropriate fear, right? The idea that like you need to be on your game and like have the awareness that if you lose your focus, bad things can happen to you this time of year. I get that. I think it's a reasonable concern to say, like, iron sharpens iron. And if you haven't really been, you know, in that, you haven't had to really fear for your life in one of these games, then, you know, are you ready for the hottest moments? I got to go the other way, though, because I'm reminded so much of, it was before we worked together, but we saw one another in Boston at the 2022 finals. And by that end of that series, Warriors Celtics, Jason Tatum had played like almost 200 more minutes than any other player, any non-Celtic in the postseason. And when they got into those late game situations, so much of what we were talking about, what Ime Udoka was talking about and what the focal point was, like, are these guys just like too, are they too gassed out? Are they too, have they just been exhausted past the point of being able to dig down deep in those late game situations? And whether, I mean, some people found, you know, thought that was a, you know, no, it wasn't about exhaustion. It was about execution. And maybe that's the case. Maybe that winds up being the issue. But like, to me, getting through these first two rounds in just like two games over the minimum with Tatum and Brown and Derek White and, you know, all your main guys not having to log those like 53-minute overtime games or whatever, I think that is, I would much rather have that and have those guys going into rounds three and four at much more manageable levels of exertion. Because also, like, the team itself, or all of those guys, with the exception of, I guess, of Kristaps Porzingis, who now has not played since April 29th, and when by the time the conference finals actually starts, could wind up being like 3 full weeks of time to rehab that calf strain. He's been doing more work on the court and practice for them. Like, so there, the idea is he ramps up and he's able to actually return to the team. Every one of these other players has played deep into, you know, an Eastern Conference Finals or into the NBA Finals before. So it's not as if none of these guys know what it takes. You know, Drew Holiday isn't joining this team with no understanding of that. Like, he won a championship in Milwaukee, has played, you know, deep into these postseason runs. So I think they've all been tested individually. They've all been tested, or much of this core has been tested collectively and has played deep into these series. I mean, the answer to that was like, I mean, all of them have, that core has come up short consistently, right? They've not actually gotten across the finish line, but that was going to be true whether these guys played 2 7-game series in the opening rounds or 2 gentlemen sweeps in the opening rounds. And so I think if you give your coin flip choice, you'd much rather have everybody fresh heading into these situations than having proven themselves against, you know, an overwhelming 8th seed or something like that.
Yeah, the flip side of what happened last night is, of course, that Cleveland is no longer. And the questions,
I mean, Cleveland exists. It hasn't, Cleveland is not no longer in terms of like its place in our reality, but the Cavs season has ended.
In terms of the Game of Thrones of who is going to be lifting that golden trophy at the end, they are no longer.
That's true.
And the questions have been out there since the second Cleveland traded for Donovan Mitchell 2 years ago. How long will he be staying with the Cavaliers? And look, he's extension eligible this summer. We've been over this. If you're listening to this show and you do not know that, and you haven't been paying attention, not to not just us, but the general NBA rumor mill landscape. And it's important because even though he is still under contract through the 24-25 season, if he does not come to terms on an extension with Cleveland this summer, of course, that would mean he will be an unrestricted free agent come this time next year. And
that can would I be... give the numbers real quick so people might understand why he might do that?
Yeah.
All right. So if he wants to stay in Cleveland and wants to sign an extension this summer, he can tack on an additional 4 years and $208.5 million onto his current deal that would tie him to the Cavs through 2029-2030. If he declines it, though, plays out next season, and then decides if he wants to, you know, get off of his player option for 25-26 and hit the open market, he could get a 5-year, almost $270 million deal from the Cavs or whichever team holds his bird rights, which, you know, TBD, TBD. Or if he wants to go someplace else free and clear, could get 4 years, $200 million, so $50 million per from another suitor there, in addition to the $37 million he's gotten on his final year of his deal. So there's like he there is a financial incentive for him to say, if I hold off a year, I can get an even bigger windfall from the Cavs or from wherever else I want to wind up being. Or if I decide I just want to wait it out and then go to a new market, a new spot, free and clear and unrestricted free agency, I'm starting at a higher max year one. And I get that like $50 million average annual value before we even get into what comes next. So financially, it makes sense for him to wait, unless he's like, really committed. Like, I just want to get it over with and make sure I'm here, which is where all the drama sort of starts to stem from.
Yeah. And look, I don't want to reiterate too much of what players anonymously said about coach, because just in general, I think, and a lot of these guys, especially like the head coaches, like Frank Vogel, are making $5-7 million a year to not work if they get fired. However, there are like three dozen people in some circumstances, more closer to two dozen on coaching staffs below those guys who are not in that position if the guy who is gets fired. And it's just a difficult kind of, balance to strike in terms of fairness and whatnot. But what I will say is that, like, I mean, I was in San Antonio the week before Showcase, right before the December 15th stuff started. So it was like mid-December. Look at that mental math. And the word was pretty strong around the league that, like, Cleveland's really thinking about whether or not to pull the plug on Bickerstaff. And that was a long time ago. If I was hearing it, he was hearing it.
Sure.
And a lot of it was being pinned on Donovan Mitchell. But it's never just so simple, right? I think in today's economy, fans, media, and rival personnel alike are super quick to just pin the career death of a coach on a player. Everyone wants to call everyone a coach killer. And I don't want to say that that is what the situation is here. But if keeping Donovan Mitchell long-term in Cleveland is the ultimate goal, and if J.B. Bickerstaff is not someone that Donovan Mitchell wants to be in Cleveland long term, the pieces all would add up pretty directly to a change of that magnitude. However, just like we talked about with Frank Vogel, we talked about Darvin Ham, like, the Cavs are going to have to think long and hard who that guy is. Mm-hmm. Like, is it Frank Vogel? He's the defensive minded championship coach that, in theory, like, resume wise, a team that was on the up and up, that rebuilt this thing, grew this organically, then traded everything for an all-star and has won one playoff series and they're looking to take this thing to the next level. He would kind of be like a standard line of thinking, but I don't know what this situation needs. I don't think they do yet either. I think Cleveland was so dead set, as we saw, on junking up the matchups to make sure that they got at least to this point. So now they're at this point. And
now what?
It'll be very curious to see how all this unfolds. Again, the biggest piece of it all is what happens with Mitchell's extension. Because just like we talked about Brandon Ingram in New Orleans and Jimmy Butler in Miami, those extensions create tension points potentially, or inflection points for how those negotiations are going to go, how overall team build is going to go. And now we're at that point. Season's over. And I'll be very curious to see what happens from here.
Yeah, just reading our guy Ben Rohrbach was there to cover the game in Boston, and his piece this morning was more about the, where do the Cavs go from here? And it's like the loud quote, J.B. Bickerstaff saying, for his part, Bickerstaff said, "I'll keep showing up until they tell me not to." And that's like, I know that's, it's a, toss it off, kind of, you know, wear it lightly sort of thing. But that's it. There are so many confounding variables to this, right? Like, you're absolutely right to note that the Mitchell, like, everything flows out of what does Donovan Mitchell want? Because it seems extraordinarily clear, going back to, you know, Dan Gilbert talking about the confidence level that the organization has in Donovan extending and staying there. Like, he is a bona fide all NBA, like, when they were cooking at their peak, like, fringe MVP candidate caliber player who is just, like, flat out better as a ball dominant, on ball, shot creating, shot making offensive engine than Darius Garland, the guy that he's been playing alongside for 2 years. So if you are going to, like, you reach a decision point sooner with Mitchell based on the extension number and based on the looming potential player option and free agency, they seem to have been representing for quite a while, we want him long term, and everything will flow from that. Whether he wants to be there, what he wants in order to be there, everything flows from there. From the Bickerstaff point of view, though, like, it's a real gotta hear both sides thing, right? Like, this franchise, this team has gotten better year over year under him. 22 wins, 44 wins in the play-in, 51 wins in the playoffs, 48 wins in an injury-ravaged season where he only had his core four guys for 32 total games, and a playoff series win. Now, yeah, they junked up the matchups, as you said, but the landmarks, he's hit them, right? And they've won and improved year over year. The other side of it, though, is it does feel like they've, even when they've had those four guys together, it has been, and those four guys, just for the purposes of naming them, Mitchell, Garland, Jared Allen, and Evan Mobley, have felt like somewhat less than the sum of their parts. You know, four all-star caliber players have yet to produce, like, overwhelming results. And it feels like it felt particularly notable. You know, you mentioned mid-December, the rumblings about Bickerstaff's, you know, tenure there. They lose Mobley and Garland at that point, and then the team suddenly is simplified and makes more sense. Mitchell, Allen, shooters everywhere, and they rip off that tremendous run that gets them into the home court advantage type position in the East before Mitchell himself goes down, and then things wobble from there. It has felt notable that the versions of this team that have made the most sense is not when all four of those guys are on the court. It is when two of those guys are on the court, and the matchups usually are Garland Mobley and Mitchell Allen. And where that feels like the inflection points here. If you want to build a more modern offense, you know, you mentioned some of the postmortem reporting has been about frustrations about the nature of the offense, whether they get up enough threes, what the ecosystem looks like. If you want to build a more simplified, more modern offense, the answer would seem to be moving away from two guys who play at their best at center offensively and two guys who play at their best at point guard offensively, and finding a way to leverage some of that into high-end wing play, which they have not had. And so, I guess, except for the point where they had Lauri Markkanen playing as a jumbo small forward, but then that's what got them Donovan Mitchell, you know? So, you know, you pays your money, you takes your chances. How much blame for them being less than the sum of their parts goes to Bickerstaff, and how much should go to Kobe Altman for the roster he constructed in this way? I think that's a reasonable question. I think, though, when you get to the point where the immediate stories are about how in jeopardy the coach's job is and not as much about how in jeopardy the front office's job is, and how who tends to be the fall guy in those situations, less the general manager than the coach, it indicates that we're pointing in a certain direction. But yeah, as you mentioned, I you better be real sure by moving off JB Bickerstaff that you've got somebody who's going to be a better, you know, either going to have the player's ears more or be able to implement a more modern, you know, high-end offensive system than Bickerstaff has been. We just saw Frank Vogel get thrown out on his keister for not getting that buy-in from his stars, right? Like, we've seen Darvin Ham be sacrificed for not getting that buy-in from his stars. It's not easy to find. So a fascinating offseason ahead, and I don't know. I think I'd be real careful if I was the Cavs. Knowing what you need to know what you've got coming in before you push what you've got out.
Yeah, they don't have a big three. They don't have a big four. They have two big bigs and two small smalls. Like, that math has been there since the second that they acquire Donovan. And I think the microscope all along has particularly been on the Donovan-Darius fit, because if we look at that deal through the context of Donovan was going to New York until he wasn't going to New York, and the questions there were about, well, are him and Brunson really going to be big enough to handle defensive assignments in the postseason? And is Donovan good enough of a player? Is he much better than Jalen to come in and be worth all of that out the door in terms of draft capital and players and whatnot to have New York really reach the highest of heights possible? And I think it'd be a really fascinating question to pull 100 people downstairs here at the combine on who's better, Donovan Mitchell or Jalen Brunson. I'd be fascinated to see what, I have no idea what people would say. I don't even know which direction I would lean, but number one, the second they traded for Donovan, to me, it was clear that the fit with Garland was going to be more of a curiosity on the offensive side of things than the defensive side of things. Not to say if it worked, but to say if it maximized the two guys. And that's the thing about team building. That's the thing that that is the element that is coursing through the Aaron Gordon fit in Denver and PJ Washington in Dallas and all that type of stuff.
Somebody should write about that Aaron Gordon fit in Denver. What do you think?
I think so. It's a really cool story. But this stuff is about maximizing the guys. It's not just, oh, let's just find someone who's good enough. It's how are we put pieces together that bring out the best in everyone? And a first-round win, their first playoff series win without LeBron James since 1922 is...
Got to check with the Elias Stats Sports Bureau about that. I'm not sure about that number, but it feels like it.
Since before the internet, it's like... it's an important thing to hang your hat on, right? But Garland from the jump, I mean, that dude was an all-star on his own the year before they brought in Donovan. And he was one of the more exciting playmakers in the league. And it has noticeably hindered his development. And I'm not unexpected. It's not unexpected to me. So that's something that The Athletic reported in their Cavs postmortem article last night that I definitely have been hearing and thinking about behind the scenes for a while too, because he's represented by Rich Paul of Clutch Sports, and the general Clutch Sports operating idea is to not clutter your guys with positional overlap and have your guys be the star guard and the star big, and they work in tandem and everyone can ride off into the sunset together, which is why, you hear stuff back in January and February, such as, oh, well, what about Zach LaVine for Darius Garland? Which, if you take a step back and look at it through that agency's perspective, that would put Darius, this is pre-Kobe White breakout, of course, that would put Darius in the backcourt alone in Chicago. Now it put Zach in Cleveland, potentially in a spot before Donovan were to ask out or whatever. And then you have your two guys running the show. It's why, Trey's no longer with the agency, but it's why back at the deadline, there was definite emphasis to try to get one of the Atlanta Hawks guards to San Antonio. So it should not be surprising to anyone paying attention that the future of Donovan Mitchell in Cleveland also is very closely tied to the future of Darius Garland in Cleveland. And also in the front court, we just have such a sample size now of, and I was talking to someone with Orlando about it here this week. What were your takeaways from your Cleveland series? And his immediate response was, I'm not sure they're better when both bigs are on the floor. And there's plenty more to explore, and we could pull up numbers and whatever, but I want to keep it moving because we've got a tight schedule here. I'll just say, to me, the questions in Cleveland are much bigger than just, will J.B. Bickerstaff stay? And will Donovan Mitchell stay, and how does that relate to the coach? Like I said at the top, that is the number one piece of the agenda, is figuring out what happens with Donovan's extension. But once you have that piece figured out, then you have a whole lot of other questions to analyze and evaluate. And Jared Allen not playing through a rib injury, which the big man on my championship rec league team texted me yesterday saying, hey, what Jared Allen didn't play through, I played through for the team. So give me my flowers. I think it says
what
more
is this
about,
big man's, do you want to give a first name so we can properly give flowers?
I'll say shout out GA. Shout out GA.
Giannis Antetokounmpo playing through rib injuries for Jake's rec league team.
And I'm not saying that Jared Allen didn't play through the pain and blah, 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 blah. But that is definitely something that has been murmuring on the ground here for sure. Like, oh, this is definitely a pain tolerance injury. Rib things traditionally are pain tolerance injuries at this stage. So if there is frustration in the org about that, to the point where it's coming out in the immediate aftermath of the loss, I could understand why. I don't know if that's going to be something that sets the stage for what they think about this dude long term, but there will be plenty of teams interested if that were to be something Cleveland wanted to explore. There'll be plenty of teams interested in Darius Garland if that was something teams wanted to explore. And I'll wrap this up by saying, in the Intelli notebook I wrote yesterday that we'll touch on later, about how in the response to Atlanta getting the number one pick, and I'll talk about their trade optionality, you know, people on the league want to see what's going to happen with Donovan first. They want to see what's going to happen with Paul George first. They want to see what's going to happen with Brandon Ingram. Like, honestly, you could put Darius Garland on that list too. I can tell you a lot of teams will have Darius Garland ranked above Trae Young on their board of wish lists, just in the fact that he has been someone who's even been agreeable to shift his role a bit depending on what type of players are coming in. And with Trae Young, you are, of course, trading for someone in theory who only wants to operate out of high pick and roll action, play after play after play. So put Darius Garland on the bingo card of potential all-stars to be considered up for grabs this summer. And we're going to take a quick break, pay some bills, and be right back. Welcome back to No Cap Room. We have a game six tonight in Minnesota, where Denver takes on the Timberwolves. Vinny Goodwill will be there. We have a game six in Indianapolis on Friday, Knicks Pacers. But we will, in the interest of time, in the interest of catching a plane, we will wish all four of those teams the best of luck. And I am certainly wishing the Atlanta Hawks luck in how they figure out what to do with the drawing here of number one in the lottery, Sunday's lottery, for many reasons. The first being, like, in this new second apron era that I'll say generally, like, and we're just going to kind of riff a little bit on the stuff people are talking about here on the ground in Chicago. There's been a general air of kind of, how the offseason's going to go. I think so many teams are still trying to figure out exactly what their plan is going to be and their plan of attack is going to be within the confines of the new cap math that they have to be working with, and also in the fact that this draft is just such a crapshoot at this point in time. Like, nobody knows who's going number one. Nobody knows who's going number two. Nobody knows who's going number three. Nobody knows which person is the most likely to go in that range at all. Like, on Monday, Sunday, definitely prevailing word, Alex Saar, most likely guy to be going into the top three. By last night, Wednesday night, I could tell you from my conversations, no one's got a fucking clue. And it's a real, I mean, it's part of it, the argument why certain teams wanted to put the draft after free agency, which I've always said, no, why are we making the game easier? Like, you're trying to do team building on all Madden, and the league certainly didn't help these teams or player representatives in terms of making the math easier to get done. But I think that, like, general air has set the stage for a lot of teams to be, you know, in the discussion as like, what are they going to do? And with Atlanta, number one, like, just the jump from 9 to 10 is a massive jump on their salary sheet for a team that hasn't been that good, that it has to address having not been that good because they are rocketing towards second apron themselves. So that little cap math right there is just like one massive wrinkle in all of that for Atlanta, which they were not expecting to have the number one pick before Sunday at approximately 1:13 local time before the sequestered drawing happened. Houston wasn't expecting to have the number three pick, you know? So I just think with Atlanta, they are one of the teams that was most active at the trade deadline in terms of being on the phone. They were not most active in terms of completed deals. They have a new strategist in tow now, an assistant general manager by the name of Ansi Salah coming over from Golden State, who is very highly regarded around the league, that I wonder what type of new ideas will come from just a general shakeup at the top of the decision tree there. But I do wonder, Dan, like, if, to me, like, the thinking was they're going to have to just take whichever of DeJounte and Trey gives you the most back. Would you be doing it that way? Or would you be wanting to pick which guy and just say, we have the number one pick anyway now. Like, our return for which one comes back isn't necessarily as important because we get to pick literally anyone we want to pair next to Jalen Johnson and which guard that we decide to keep.
Yeah. I think they've arrived at the point where they maybe have to just say, what is our best return? Like, what's the most amount of stuff we can get? If it was me, and I don't know, I feel like we've talked about this before. This might just be like residual trauma from watching Trae Young just like dice up the Knicks in the playoffs a few years ago. I think Trae Young is better than DeJounte Murray, full stop. And I think if you need to build around one of them, I would be doing what I could to keep Trae Young and find try to figure out the next way to build a team around him. That said, like, I would understand the decision makers looking at this and saying, well, we've tried several different ways of doing this and none of them have fully worked. And the one through line in these builds is we can never be good on defense because we have Trae Young, but because the specific particulars of building around him have resulted in trade-offs that just keep us kind of middling as opposed to the high-end team we believe we can be. I would be so reticent to move off of that kind of high-end offensive talent. That I feel like I said high-end like 16 times in this podcast. But the like, when you get into these games, these situations, you need the locksmith. You need the guy who can find the answer, manipulate the chessboard, and create advantages. I don't think DeJounte Murray is that kind of player. And I don't think that, I mean, there's reason to dream very big about Jalen Johnson and the whichever prospect you take at number one. Certainly you'd hope that person would also have an all-star type of ceiling. I think I would be saying, I want another crack at trying to build the armor around this guy. Cause I think if we can put him in there, get him into these situations, into this sort of series with the right supporting structure, that's our better chance of advancing in these series than like a more balanced but lower wattage team around DeJounte Murray. But so much of it, I guess, as you said, depends on who you like at number one. And I am like completely an idiot about draft stuff. I learn about these guys in the process once the season's over. And then even then, like really only when they start playing NBA basketball. But I do love that this year's draft, the particular version of it seems to be, this guy's got all the tools. He's also bad at basketball. Like, this guy is huge and his arms are great. And you could see the outlines of a jumper. He's currently bad at basketball. But, you know, there's a lot to like here. And then that you could sort of interchange. You mentioned the wheel of Game of Thrones, like any of 10 guys moving up to the top of that. So I don't know. I'm interested to find out who they think is potentially good at basketball.
I'm curious what you think the fit of Trae Young and Victor Wembanyama would look like. Because that's been something that's been in the rumor mill forever. I have always thought that that was more of a wishful thinking on Trey's side of things. Or like we were talking about, Clutch trying to put their players in positions to thrive along a co-star. And I've just never been told that that is something San Antonio would like as well. So I see the logic. This guy could arguably be the greatest lob thrower in NBA history. He is such a pick and roll maestro. Like, I remember back at Oklahoma, everyone was losing their minds about the Steph comparisons because he could pull up and step back from 35. But to me, Trey's greatest skill set has always been his playmaking out of the pick and roll. And if there
Absolutely.
Were... If he would lean into more of being a playmaker and not a scorer, like that could be something that a winning situation would benefit from. I don't think the Spurs want to trade for Trae Young. They are looking at building around this Victor Wembanyama dude, the 7'4" alien who everyone in Chicago is already anointing as a future top five player of all time. You're going to really pick your shot if you're going to trade for a supermax contract point guard who has obvious limitations, even if he is so gifted that he can cover up for his defensive deficiencies. But to go back to that maximizing your players point, are you trying to have to overextend, even though he's as overextended physically as any person could imaginably be? Do you really want to overextend your second year center and have part of his development have to be masking your all-star who makes $200 million weaknesses? That doesn't really seem to jive to me with how San Antonio has traditionally operated. So my question here is, do you agree with me or am I wrong?
Well, I can agree with you and you could still be wrong. That's certainly not, those are not mutually exclusive ideas. But yeah, the thing that, the phrase that keeps rattling around in my brain is Pop so often, Greg Popovich has so often talked about in the way that the Spurs have sort of brought in talent or looked at evaluating players. Like, they want guys who have gotten over themselves, right? And I don't know Trae Young. I've never sat and interviewed Trae Young. I can't speak to that. But like 6 years into his career, I think there's still reasonable questions about like how willing is Trae Young to do stuff that isn't just in service of the maximization of Trae Young's individual productivity. I think there were steps in that direction this year. I mean, he got deserved praise from some of the like tape watching sickos for being a harder defender this year. Like, he actually put in more effort defensively.
Quinn Snyder gave him that praise.
Yeah. And there was, I think there was a couple times where he was like, why isn't anybody writing about that? And it's like, because you guys are boring and no one really wants to pay attention to the Hawks because you're within one game of 500 for 3 years. But the perennial off, Will he be willing to work off the ball? Will he be willing to set some screens? And then, you know, like all that kind of stuff. 6 years in, the answer to those things is kind of like, you know, not really. And so from that perspective, I could see San Antonio saying, like, without necessarily any shade toward Trey as an individual performer, but like maybe not a culture fit in terms of the way that we want to build the roster out. That said, like, is it more of a hindrance to Victor's development to have to be covering for his diminutive point guard or to have very few people who pass him the ball and can do that at an elite level? I'm of the opinion that, like, if they wanted to, you know, it's the same, you know, we talked about with Oklahoma City, not, you know, Sam Presti talks about like not, you know, rushing through your breakfast. Like, you got to actually see what these guys look like in competitive moments before you make decisions on where you go next. The Spurs are in a very similar spot with their extra draft capital, with their young players. If they just wanted to say, we think we had a pretty good thing going there with Trey Jones, Devin Vassell, and Wembanyama, we think there's a core there to build around. Let's see that for like a full season with a little bit more help on the wing. And before we make any rash decisions on super max level contracts, I can see that. So yeah, to me, it would be more surprising for San Antonio to make that move than it would be, like you mentioned him earlier, it would make more sense to me for San Antonio to say, what's it going to cost to get Garland out of Cleveland? Like mm-hmm. that makes a lot more sense to me. But you know, that obviously is contingent on other factors. So I think that's one I would be keeping an eye on, just without any reporting on it for myself, like just a situation fit that might make more sense to me. But you know, still a lot to be determined on both sides of that potential transaction.
Yeah. Spurs got the 4th and the 8th picks, of course, if you haven't been paying attention, in the lottery. So they've been definitely a team of the combine in addition to Atlanta. We only have time for one more, but I'll say, you know, Philly and what they'll do with their cap space is definitely still top of mind, especially like people have been wondering and asking, what would you do if you're Philly, if you decide you want Paul George and Paul George doesn't come or he doesn't leave the Clippers at all? That's been an interesting thought experiment. Like, how would you break that cap space up if the max guy you want to give it to isn't available? The Pistons, of course, falling from 1 to 5 again while they look for a new president of basketball operations. And questions still abound whether or not, depending on who emerges from that search, if Monty Williams will still stick around. That is still a question that is out there.
So if you're Tom Gores, you have to just be like, no, man, you're sticking around, dog. Like, there's a sunk cost component to it, but that is a sunk giant cost at that point.
For sure. But to keep the through line of Trey, the Lakers are one team that definitely has registered interest. They just also have interest in other guys, too. Like Donovan Mitchell, for one. And they've always been high on Darius Garland there too. And I would think maybe Garland's price point would be lesser than Trey's, maybe. I don't know. But it's definitely, at first blush, I would think that if Garland's available, it's probably because Donovan's sticking around. And there'd be less onus on Cleveland to like, we need to sell this guy for the greatest bid possible. We just sent three picks out the door for DeJounte Murray, blah, blah, blah. Like, obviously, that's Atlanta's situation, not theirs. But with the Lakers and their head coaching search up in the air, that's been probably one of the bigger talking points throughout the week as well. As I'm packing up, my bag is packed. I will pack up this equipment the second we're like in 5 minutes when we're done doing this. JJ Redick does seem to be the leader in the clubhouse. The fact that there is prevailing word that this search could go beyond the finals so that he can fulfill his obligations that Doc Rivers was not able to, would seem to be a pretty good indicator that he's got a real, real good shot. I think just the thing I want to say, and I kind of, I guess, I'm applauding the Lakers by saying this, it does seem to be that LA is really focusing on this offseason from a coaching search standpoint and like whoever they're able to use these picks and space to go get, from the lens of, we definitely want to compete with LeBron, but also keep moving forward with the Anthony Davis era beyond that, which of course is what I think is the pragmatic way to approach it. But sometimes pragmatism and logic does not rule the day in NBA decision-making. So the fact that that has been the consistent word for the Lakers, are about the Lakers. And there's other stuff too, like whether or not D'Angelo Russell will pick up his player option. I would say the overwhelming majority of people here are saying, if I'm advising D'Angelo, you don't have any leverage, as you said in your post-game exit interview, like just pick up the option. Is there going to be $20-ish million available to you on the open market? Doesn't seem to be the expectation around the league right now, but I will wrap this up and wrap up talking on the show by saying, I'm encouraged for that line of thinking moving forward if the Lakers are indeed trying to thread this needle of let's get good stuff now, but also from coach to the rest of the roster. But also we're thinking about the now and then in a post-LeBron world that I think is smart and what they should be doing. So shout out Hollywood.
Shout out to Hollywood. No truth to the rumors that because JJ Redick said one nice thing about me once on Twitter, I'm in consideration for a staff position. No,
I wish.
I don't. I think that's not a life that I would be suited to or any good at.
If we get funny screenshots of you every podcast, I'd love to see your face on the bench in real time as you're trying to help crack the puzzle that's being solved and you don't have 7 hours post-game to think about it.
That's really, really funny. Yeah, no, I mean, I would have to really work hard on my expressive face. I would have to dramatically, you know, or wear a mask. That might be an option for me. It feels like JJ Redick, the idea is, can we hit the like Steve Kerr straight? And that is... I get it.
Or Steve Nash.
Well, that's down that path can lie some rakes to step on and smash you in the face.
But the Warriors hit Steve Kerr straight. So like, do you want to hit Steve Nash straight is kind of where I was thinking. But yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that you want to hit that one. I mean, I guess, and the other part would maybe be like, the last time we had like a career role player who wound up taking a turn as a broadcaster and then coming in to run the Lakers. Like, we got Pat Riley. So maybe, maybe that's the idea. But Riley had also been an assistant for a while and stuff like that.
I mean, I've heard that. Like, I think that's not a nothing thing. Like, it worked for Riles in LA. I think that's a non-zero % of the interest in process. JJ.
Yeah, that's wild. But also, when is everything going on with the Lakers not wild? There's a reason we talk about them a lot. And it's not just because they have a lot of fans, it's because they also have a lot of insane stuff happening almost all the time. So something to keep an eye on. Go six. Get me out of here.
That's all we got for you today. Thanks to John Gennaro, who does all the things to make the show look and sound great. And that reference is from Mike Conley. We hope Mike Conley's Achilles heals up well.
Yes.
Shout out Mike Conley, one of the good guys. I hope Mike Conley subscribes to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube. And I hope you subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on and give us a 5-star review. We thank you for listening. And we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.